This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and this is the program looking at the underreported, hidden, and sometimes neglected. If you want to hear more, you can follow us regularly. Listen and learn more about all the different topics that we highlight at RedIceCreations.com. Helen Caldicott is an Australian physician, author, Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and an anti-nuclear advocate who has founded several associations dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, war and military action in general. Dr. Caldicott has written books, developed dozens of videotapes and films, written scores of articles which have appeared in nearly every major newspaper and magazine, spoken at major universities throughout the world, and has met with heads of state everywhere. She founded and headed Physicians for Social Responsibility and also Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, or WAND for short. In this one-hour program, we are going to talk about Fukushima and nuclear energy. All right, this is going to be a really interesting program. Timely, as always, of course, when we are talking about these kinds of subject and important as well, of course. Helen Caldicott is with us on the line. First of all, welcome, Helen. Thank you for taking the time talking with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. This is going to be interesting. Now, before we get into today, if you will, the troubles that we currently face, I want to talk about your work and your activism, if you will. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your background. I mean, what I know so far is that back in 1980, after the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, you left your medical profession to basically focus on the issue of nuclear weapons and the insanity of nuclear power and everything else. What was it about that affected you so much, Helen, to quit your job?
Well, I've always been deeply concerned about nuclear weapons in particular since I was about 16, and I read a book called On the Beach by an Australian called Neville Shute, and it was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident and everyone in the world died except people in Melbourne, Australia, which is so far south, but gradually the radiation reached Melbourne and everyone died. So I, being curious disposition, have always read everything I can find about nuclear weapons. And then I went to medical school and learned about what radiation does to genes and how abnormal genes incurred by radiation are passed on generation to generation, and it also causes cancer. And so right in the depths of my bones, I guess, I've been deeply concerned about all things nuclear. But what convinced me to actually leave my position at Harvard Medical School, and I was in the faculty there, was that I went to the Soviet Union with a Quaker delegation from America, and I learned two things. One, that America was about to deploy cruise missiles in Europe, which were unverifiable, which could be hidden in haystacks and the like, which would end the process of arms control. And two, they were going to put Pershing 2 missiles in Germany, which would hit Moscow in 3 minutes, which would mean, you know, there was no just crazy stuff. And I went back to Harvard and saw people pouring things into test tubes. And I thought, what are you doing this for? Because there's probably going to be a nuclear war, and that'll be the end of everything. And I didn't want to leave my position. It was one of the best I could have in the world. And I went to the door of my boss three times, and finally I went in and I said, I have to leave. And he said, yes, I know. And I walked out into the street outside Harvard on Longwood Avenue, and I just felt naked. I wasn't a clever doctor at Harvard anymore. But then I got so involved in leading the movement for a nuclear weapons free and against nuclear weapons in America and the like, and founding my Physicians for Social Responsibility, that I didn't have time to regret it. But now I really love medicine. It is my vocation, like being a nun, and I do miss it very much.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. Now, one of the recent articles on your website I was reading as well is, obviously, you've since 1980, you spent the rest of your time focusing on this issue. And has the criticism fallen on deaf ears, if you will? I mean, the article goes on talking a little bit about that you might have spent your life, warning the world about these terrible dangers, but potentially in vain. Is that how you feel today?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, I helped mobilize with others and my 23,000 doctors in the early 80s, about 80% of Americans. When I first went to America in 78, most people would say to me, it's better to be dead than red. In other words, I'd rather have a nuclear war than be communist. And I thought, this is really crazy. So I started the physicians movement, and over 5 years, by pure education and describing to people what a bomb dropping on Boston would do to Boston, like vaporize most people, at the end of 5 years, 80% of Americans were opposed to the concept of nuclear war. And Gorbachev heard us talk, the physicians, and we kind of led the movement in America. And I think that we actually did help to bring about the end of the Cold War. I think there's no doubt about that. And some people say, you know, I helped to stop a nuclear war because Reagan was so very warlike. But who knows, because we haven't had one. However, what really worries me is that instead of the weapons being removed when America and Russia became friends, they're still in place. These Cold War warriors are addicted to these nuclear weapons. That's why I call one of my books Missile Envy. I think there's a deep psychological addiction to these extraordinarily powerful weapons.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so there are still enough weapons in America and Russia on hair trigger alert to be launched with a 3-minute decision time by Putin or Obama, and nuclear war would be over in an hour. And it could happen tonight by accident, by computer error, by hackers hacking into the early warning system. So we all still live on the edge or the brink of the nuclear precipice every second of every day, and yet people pretend or don't know it's there. So we're all in a state of acute psychic numbing, blocking out reality and the dangers that face us.
You're right. I think that continues as well with even the disasters we have faced so far. And this is one of the items I want to talk about later as we get into Fukushima here, obviously. But, I mean, there's, by the way, I love that polarized discussion that there are, you know, basically there are no options beyond either nuclear war or we have to convert to communism. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I think we've been kind of pushed up against the wall.
I mean, the Americans had a case of, I think, acute psychosis at the time. I said, well, you know, what about the pygmies in Africa? They'll be killed too in a nuclear war. And they said to me, they literally said, well, they don't want to be communists either.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, they were really insane at the time, if you look at it clearly.
You bet. What I see, Helen, is that there's many different factions to the nuclear story, obviously. We have nuclear power, nuclear weapons. You've been writing about depleted uranium, which is another factor that the majority of people out there don't even know about. But we had Chernobyl after this, back in 1986, another nuclear power incident disaster. What happened for you during this period? I mean, you must have been pretty upset about the fact that it continued like this, right?
Well, it was an absolute unmitigated disaster, and I remember being on a telephone in the Kansas airport with a man from the ABC radio in America, and he said to me, literally, he said, well, they're only just Russians. And I said, I'm a physician. Every human life is precious, you know. So there was an attitude that had happened in Russia, and also the Russian reactors were no good because, you know, they were built under communist control. And the Russians said the American reactors are no good because they're built under capitalism and they cut corners. Well, anyway, the Chernobyl disaster happened because there was a very illiterate man in control in the middle of the night. He was a specialist in hydroelectricity, not nuclear. He did a crazy experiment, and the thing literally exploded. There was an atomic excursion, and it burnt for 10 days, and 40% of Europe is now radioactive still and will be for hundreds of years. I don't eat European food because I don't know what food is radioactive, because the food concentrates the radiation, and what food is not. And a recent report by the New York Academy of Sciences says that now over 1 million people have died as a result of Chernobyl, 1 million. And that's just the first 25 years. And cesium, which is an isotope that is all over Europe, but many other, you know, many other isotopes are too. Cesium lasts for 600 years. Plutonium, and a lot of plutonium escapes, that lasts for 500,000 years. Strontium lasts for 600 years. So we're talking about time frames that none of us can imagine, and already we've seen the results that hundreds of thousands of people have died of cancer and all sorts of other diseases that I could go into if you wanted me to.
Absolutely. I think we should do that as well, talk a little bit more about that later. I wanted to ask you before we move ahead, though, if Chernobyl is a gruesome way of looking at it, but is that really the best comparison we have to Fukushima so we can understand what has happened, or is there anything else?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, engineers have estimated how much radiation got out at Fukushima, and they say it's 2.5 to 3 times greater, the radiation release, than was released at Chernobyl. Now, Japan is much more heavily populated than the area around Chernobyl, A, and B, if you multiply 1 million people dead in the first 25 years by 2.5 to 3, in Japan you come up with a startling statistic, you know, 2.5 million to 3 million in the next 25 years dying. And I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility. So we're talking about a disaster of unbound proportions. And, you know, so many journalists will say to me, well, no one's died yet. Well, we don't expect people to drop dead unless they get a whopping dose of radiation. I think actually some of the workers who have been exposed to very high levels have died.
Oh, yeah,
and have,
for sure.
And some have been seriously ill. But there's a big cover-up there by TEPCO and the Japanese government, so we don't really know what's going on. But certainly one-third of a number of children who've been studied in Fukushima have thyroid tumours, and they've been diagnosed by ultrasound, and they are not being biopsied. They're not taking the tumours out or the cysts to see if they're malignant or not. And so many of those children are destined to die. And we don't expect solid cancers to start appearing for at least 5 years. This is within the first year. So things are very serious.
Is the severity of the situation really being acknowledged by big media around the world, would you say?
Not at all. No. I think there's a combination of factors there. There's a big cover-up by the Japanese government. And they admit they covered up how much radiation got out, and they didn't tell the people where the main radioactive plume went, and people evacuated and fled into the main path of the plume. They didn't tell the people there'd been 3 meltdowns. Not for 3 months did they tell them that. And the meltdowns occurred within the first 48 hours. The other thing is there's a cover-up, I'm sure, in America going on. The Americans are not being told the truth. I also think that many people in the media are ignorant. They're not, they're not radio biologists. They believe what the nuclear industry says, and the nuclear industry is spending millions of dollars in huge propaganda campaigns to convince people that everything's okay and they can continue with nuclear power. And this is really, it's more than irresponsible. It's quite wicked. And people like me, physicians and my colleagues, we don't have the sort of money to conduct huge, you know, media campaigns to say everything's hunky-dory and that nuclear power is safe. And in fact, Fukushima's nothing to worry about.
I want to get into what the effects are of this, of course, in the long term, and maybe if there are short-term effects as well. But do you know where we are now when it comes to the having Fukushima under control? I mean, obviously, as you say, we're very, very suspicious with information that comes out from TEPCO just inherently at this stage, because so much in the past they've just simply lied about that. But, I mean, could it get worse from here? I hear stories about the fact that reactor number 4 could literally, if another earthquake hits or something like this.
Yes.
What do you know about this?
Okay, well, reactor 4, they removed all this radioactive fuel from the reactor for some reason just before the earthquake occurred, and put it in a cooling pool for spent fuel rods, which are viciously, voraciously, thermally hot and radioactively hot. In the cooling pool, it stands 100 feet above the ground on the roof of the reactor. Now, the roof itself of the building has been blown off. So that cooling pool is not protected by any roof. It's exposed to the elements. It has to be continually cooled by water, and sometimes the water level falls quite low. And if it loses its cooling water, it too will melt down and burn. Now, the problem is the building number 4 has been terribly weakened and damaged by the earthquake. So if there's another earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, that building could collapse. If that building collapses, down comes the cooling pool, and there it will lose its water and its coolant, and the fuel rods will burn and release 10 times more cesium than was released at Chernobyl, but also, you know, over 100 other radioactive elements. If that happens, the Japanese government is saying openly that they're going to have to evacuate Tokyo. Well, Tokyo has 30 million people.
Yeah, how do you do that?
That's right. And you can't evacuate Tokyo. So where do people go? And they say that'll be the end of Japan, but more than that, it's going to be just disastrous for the whole of the Northern Hemisphere, because that radiation will be released to the four winds and blow around the Northern Hemisphere. So you're all going to be in trouble up there. I happen to live in Australia.
Yeah. Is it going to eventually come, as you said before, there is a spread across the hemispheres, but this just takes longer time or what?
What, after Building 4 goes down?
Well, I mean, then at that point, I think the whole, exactly, as things are right now.
Oh, a lot of radiation, huge amounts, has escaped, and it has contaminated the whole of the Northern Hemisphere. But Japan was most heavily contaminated, as was the Pacific Ocean, and is still being contaminated. I mean, untold amounts of radioactivity have been poured into the Pacific Ocean, which, of course, reconcentrates back in the food chain by orders of magnitude from algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, and then us. And so it's not a good idea to eat fish caught in the Pacific Ocean. They're already finding cesium in tuna that are caught off the coast of California. And, you know, no one should be eating Japanese food, Japanese seaweed or Japanese fish. Much of the rice in Fukushima Prefecture is contaminated with cesium, as is their green tea, their leafy vegetables, their mushrooms, you name it. And they're still feeding radioactive food to their children. And children are up to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. They get cancer more readily. And little girls are twice as sensitive as little boys. We don't know why. Fetuses are thousands of times more sensitive. So we're dealing with a medical catastrophe the likes of which the world has never seen before.
In your view, Helen, is there any reliable sources that actually are reporting on the amount of radiation that is spreading around the world right now? There's been a number of strange incidents as well. Consequently, after Fukushima, different plants, it's been spikes reported here and there where they, you know, try to detect the levels, etc. What can you say about this?
Well, I do know that in the first few weeks after and months after Fukushima, the ambient levels of radiation went up 40,000 times above normal over Seattle. So that just indicates that there was a huge amount of radiation being blown around the Northern Hemisphere, and it was coming down with rainfall, because that's when the fallout occurs. The rain brings the radiation down onto the land and into the sea and into the plants, where it's concentrated in the milk and the meat and the vegetables and the whole thing. The awful thing is that, of course, you can't taste, smell, or see radioactive elements in the food. You don't say, I can taste the cesium in this fish I'm eating. The other thing is to know that it takes 5 to 70 years to develop cancer once you've eaten radioactive elements in your food or inhaled radioactive elements in the air. So there's a long, latent, silent period. Radiation is a silent killer. And then again, no cancer identifies its origin. It doesn't have a little flag saying, this breast cancer was made by some strontium 90 you drank in some milk 20 years ago when you were lactating.
You can't track it back that far either. It becomes difficult to know exactly.
Well, you can't, because cancer is caused by many different things,
right?
Like we live with 80,000 chemicals in common use, many of which are carcinogenic, and they react synergistically. They potentiate the action of radioactive elements, and that's called synergism. So, and also background radiation induces cancer. I mean, what people need to know is no radiation is safe. All radiation is cumulative. Each dose you receive adds to your risk of getting cancer. Never walk through those X-ray machines at the airports. Do not have any unnecessary X-rays at all. Do not have CT scans if you can possibly help it, because they give you a whopping dose of radiation. But if you have, you know, cough up some blood, you do need a chest X-ray, because the risk of not diagnosing a lung cancer is much greater than the risk of having a single chest X-ray. But be very judicious and cautious.
Now, Helen, where are the countries demanding to help to fix this problem? I mean, again, this is on Japanese soil, yes, but it's affecting the whole world, the whole Northern Hemisphere at this point anyway. Where shouldn't there be experts from all over the world working day and night to try to resolve this and get it under control as quickly as possible?
Well, it's absolutely extraordinary that that is not happening. I mean, the United Nations should be in there with the best experts from the United States and from Europe and Canada, right in there, you know, building this other building at Building 4. They need to build a new building so that they can put the cranes on top of the building to remove those spent fuel rods in the spent fuel pool in Building 4. And that will take 2 or 3 years to happen, because the cranes were destroyed, the original cranes, in the explosion that occurred, the hydrogen explosion. It's quite extraordinary to me that other nations who will be impacted if Building 4 collapses. And the other thing I didn't say is, if Building 4 goes, there'll be so much radiation, all workers at the site will have to be evacuated immediately. And that means there could be further hydrogen explosions as the hydrogen is building up in units 1, 2, and 3. Or more meltdowns. I mean, the disaster is beyond compare, and it will be a cascading effect, a sort of a nuclear cascade accident if Building 4 goes. And the world is kind of sitting by, either ignoring it or pretending it's not going on or not taking any notice, because the nuclear industry wants to keep going.
It's absolutely amazing. So obviously there is a window right here, basically, because there is, at some point, there is going to be another earthquake, right? So there is a window here to...
That's what they say. That's what the seismologists are saying.
Wow. Well, this is just extraordinary. How could this happen then? How did Japan not see the potential risk? Obviously, they did. They knew this, but how did it happen? Why?
Well, I'll tell you how it happened. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese were extraordinarily allergic to anything nuclear. They just hated it. And the Americans got together with some Japanese people and said, "Look, we're going to give you peaceful nuclear power plants, and." If people know that their electricity is generated from peaceful nuclear power, and furthermore, when they put the reactors in certain little fishing villages, they gave them a lot of money and they could build new halls and roads and schools. They were bribed. And so the nuclear power was a sort of a Trojan horse into the Japanese culture, which was so shocked by anything nuclear. And that has been documented. If you go to my webpage, nuclearfreeplanet.org, there's an article there somewhere documenting how the Americans, on purpose, injected nuclear power into Japan. Now, Japan, the archipelago of Japan, is volcanic and is seismically extremely active. And so they built, you know, 6 reactors at Fukushima on an earthquake fault. That's what they did, and many of their reactors, 54 of them in total, are built on earthquake faults or near earthquake faults. The other thing was that there was a deal with the Japanese that they could become involved with nuclear weapons too. I can't exactly remember how all the details of that, but again, if you go to my webpage, you'll find the article that was a very good article that did the research into this. dreadful dynamic which was set up by the United States.
So American companies obviously are in there setting this up, and how? But why did the Japanese accept? They could have said, no, we have other options, right? But they didn't.
Oh, look, I think they were bribed. I think that that the nuclear industry in Japan got involved and saw it could make money. I think that the splitting of the atom has an enormous psychological impact for many men, that it's so potently powerful. And I think I'd go back to what Henry Kissinger once said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. So, and of course, Japan is a very sexist society. The men reign supreme, as we know, although the women are starting to rise up now. And so I think there are various dynamics going on.
Does the computer virus Stuxnet have anything to do with this? I mean, again, that's designed to hit Siemens computers that, you know, the Fukushima Daiichi plant was running on. Microsoft Windows is also how it spreads accordingly. What's your opinion on this?
No, I don't think Stuxnet had anything to do with that. Stuxnet was designed, of course, to destroy the centrifuges for enriching uranium, specifically in Iran. But it has spread quite far and wide, and they've got another virus now they're injecting into that system. So you can't, once it starts, you can't stop it from spreading. But I'm sure, from everything I've read, that Stuxnet had nothing to do with the Fukushima accident. Nothing. Well, it was an earthquake, I mean, and the tsunami. That's what happened.
Now, in your opinion, did they handle this better in well, it's Ukraine today, the former Soviet Union, Chernobyl there. Did they handle that better at this stage, if we compare the timeline, if we can compare it? I know there's vastly different reasons how this happened and so forth. But, I mean, there they managed to build a sarcophagus around that. I mean, should we have expected this to be done already in Japan, or
well,
are we expecting too much?
I don't think they could have built a sarcophagus around the three meltdowns. And as we know, the Russians dropped tons of lead and sand onto the damaged reactor, and then they also excavated underneath to put boron water, so that if the reactor molten fuel went down, it wouldn't explode as it hit the ground at groundwater. And they did build a sarcophagus, which is no good, and it's rusting and leaking. Birds are nesting inside it. They're building another one over the top. But that molten fuel, they finally found it. It melts like a sort of lava from a volcano, and it melted way down beneath the reactor. And there still could be another accident there, I believe. But the Russians were much more proactive, and they evacuated large numbers of populations, and the Japanese haven't done that. They've evacuated a few people, but there are children now in areas where children were evacuated, where it's so radioactive that people were evacuated around Chernobyl. Well, they're still living there in Japan. They're going to school, they're playing in playgrounds, which are incredibly radioactive. They come into their houses, and they've got radioactive dust on their shoes. Parts of Tokyo are extremely radioactive. There was an engineer who I interviewed, nuclear engineer, who went to Tokyo and took 5 samples of soil from the footpaths and from the roofs of buildings and from moss, and took it back and analyzed. And it's so radioactive, this is in Tokyo, that it would in America have to be disposed of in a nuclear waste dump. It's so radioactive. So the Japanese have covered up much more than the Russians did. I mean, it took Gorbachev some days to admit to the world what had happened, but once it started, they sent in 600,000 military people to try and curb the accident and evacuate mm-hmm. people. Well, I haven't seen anything like that in Japan at all.
Yeah, that's right. It was only after it was reported in Sweden, actually, heightened levels of radiation that the Russians admitted to it, interestingly enough. But
that's right.
There's been a debacle about waste depositories and how to store this. I mean, this is again long-term issue that we're faced with. It's something that's going to continue into the future, whether we want it or not at this stage, unless, you know, there's some magical technology or something developed that renders this inert in some way. But what can you say about waste depositories and the world's planning for this? How are we going to deal with all of this in the future? I mean, just the spent fuel alone.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. And I've been arguing with the nuclear industry for 40 years, and they say to me, don't worry, we're good scientists. We'll find the cure to radioactive waste. And I say, look, that's like me saying to a patient, you've got pancreatic cancer and you'll probably die in 6 months, but don't worry, I'm a good doctor. In 20 years' time, I'll find the cure. There is no cure to the storage of radioactive waste. That's the problem. Now, and on Kali in Finland, they're digging a very deep, deep hole in the granite.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful film called Into Eternity by a man called Michael Marsden. And if you go to my website again, I actually interviewed him on my radio program, which can be downloaded at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. And it's the most profound interview I have ever done.
I saw the movie, Helen. Sorry to cut you off, but I saw the movie and I recommended it last time we talked about Fukushima here. It's a really interesting movie. Scary as hell.
Well, he takes us into latitudes and longitudes of time that we never consider, like eternity. And it just takes your breath away. You end up watching the film and listening to the interview I did on my radio program and you become speechless and almost paralyzed, because no one knows what to do with it. I mean, it's absolutely criminal and wicked what they're doing. And I have to say, when Oppenheimer, who designed the first atomic bombs, watched the first ones blow up, the first one, which was called Trinity, named after the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost in 1945, he quoted from the Bhagavad Gita,
I have
become death, the destroyer of worlds. And he said at that time, for the first time, physicists have known sin, and they have been sinning ever since. And the sin is compounded and compounded and compounded.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to ask you just briefly here if you heard about there was a debacle here at Forsmark nuclear power plant, the repository, the storage thing. They had developed some kind of something with the canisters that they were going to store underneath at the, Gulf of Botnia, pretty much. And the fact is that there was some miscalculation. I'm not fully read up on the story, but there was basically a huge error. This was the plan where they planned to put the fuel in here. But if they would have, you know, proceeded and gone ahead, it would have been a disaster. It'd be like 500 times Fukushima, basically. And it ended happening, of course. But did you hear about this?
No, I did not hear about that.
All right,
no.
Well, I can add a few links to that on the website, because it's a pretty interesting story, and I reckon that this is happening around the world as well. The case in the film, by the way, that you mentioned with Madsen there, Into Eternity, that's just one location from one little nuclear power plant in Finland, right? And it's not even for their entire supply, far from it. But it shows the incredible lengths they have to go to and the money they have to spend to put this away. Does the rest of the world have anything even remotely similar in terms of a plan to get this away?
Absolutely nothing. Nothing. America's got 74,000 tons of this high-level waste from its nuclear reactors. Nowhere to put it, and it's all sitting in cooling pools. Now, some cooling pools, there's 30 times more radiation in the cooling pools than there is in the reactor core itself. And in the reactor core is as much radiation as that released by 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. What can you say? These men are madmen. They really are madmen, nuclear madmen. And they keep going, and they keep going, and because most politicians are scientifically illiterate, both in physics or radiation biology or genetics or medicine, thus they can keep going. There's some sort of fascination that society has for these nuclear things, and it'll be our death. It'll be the end of us. You know, the radioactive waste will, over time, leak out of any canister you put it in. It will contaminate the water supplies. It will reconcentrate back in the food. And over time will induce epidemics of cancer, leukemia and genetic disease and deform babies forevermore. That's the legacy that we leave from our nuclear activities all over the world. It's sort of random, compulsory genetic engineering forevermore.
So it's done, it's there. Obviously it can get much worse from here, but where, in your opinion, do we go from here? What's the next step? If you were given free reins, if you will, then how would you begin to deconstruct this, and in what area could we go? What's the likely alternatives here?
If I was the president of the United States, I'd close every single reactor down overnight, 104 of them. I commissioned a study a few years ago called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, which you can get at my website, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, which says that by 2030, 2040, America could be absolutely free of carbon-induced energy and nuclear-induced energy, that there's enough renewable energy right now to supply the whole of America with wind power, solar power, tidal power, geothermal power, you name it. The reason it isn't happening is because the oil companies and the fossil fuel companies, they get $1 trillion a year in compensation, for God's sake, from the American government. They run the government. That's what they do. They run the government and the politicians. And so wickedness prevails when, in fact, if they covered every American house with solar panels and there were windmills everywhere, it would employ hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. GDP would go up. And, you know, it would be great for the economy, great for the people, and great for the planet. We know that Germany now, 40% of its electricity now is coming from renewables. Well, I think nearly 50%. And Germany doesn't have a lot of sun, but you can have solar panels even when it's cloudy. I mean, why isn't California, every house in California covered with solar panels? They're cheap as dirt now, and every house would become independently energy self-sufficient. And it's just not happening. So do we have a collective death wish?
Do we?
Well, I think we probably must.
That's interesting. When it comes to, I mean, you've already mentioned some of the alternative sources, of course, but if you could see research and money being poured into something else, what would that be in your
view? There's nothing else you need. Nothing else you need. I mean, sun shines down every day, all the time. The wind blows. You can store the electricity. People say you can't, but you can store it. Baseload power is easily available from renewables. There is nothing else we need. We don't have to develop anything else. It's here, ready to go. The Danes, I mean, I love the Danes. They're leading in developing wind power. And as one Danish man said, I don't want to have a child with six fingers.
Yep, well, there you go. Well, what about the nuclear weapons? I mean, you mentioned U.S., Russia, but let's not forget France, U.K., China. Israel have, you know, more weapons than most nations now. Now India, Pakistan, North Korea, etc. The list goes on. What can be done about these weapons, do you think?
All right. Well, number one, they're pushing nuclear power plants all over the world. And, of course, nuclear power plants are bomb factories. Each reactor manufactures 250 kilos of plutonium a year, and you need 5 kilos to make a bomb. QED, say no more. So each reactor is a bomb factory, and any country that gets a reactor can make bombs, which is what India did with her reactors and the like. So we're exporting bombs and we're exporting cancer with nuclear power plants. America and Russia still have over 1,000 hydrogen bombs each, or more like 2,000, on hair trigger alert, ready to go with a press of the button by either Putin or Obama. And a nuclear war, the weapons once launched take half an hour to go from launch to land and vice versa, and the nuclear war would be over in an hour. You only need 1,000 bombs dropping on 100 cities to produce nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth, with a huge cloud of black smoke engulfing the planet, blocking out the sun for up to 10 years inducing a short ice age in everyone, and everything would freeze to death in the dark. Now, that could happen tonight. We frequently have computer errors where they almost launch these weapons by accident. People are hacking into the early warning system in the Pentagon, including the Chinese, so it could go off tonight. Obama could make a mistake. The early warning system has been set off frequently by things like a rising moon or a flock of geese or whatever. I mean, we are living on hair trigger nuclear catastrophe every second of every day, and no one talks about it. We did during the Cold War, and when the Berlin Wall fell, we thought, thank God it's over. It's not over. And America and Russia are friends now. So they're still threatening to blow up the planet every second of every day. Why? God only knows.
There's always a new boogeyman, right? They're going to be
what?
There's always a new boogeyman as well out there that's going to be, you know, that's necessary that we need these weapons
what,
for.
To right? blow up the planet.
Yeah.
For boogeyman.
Yeah. It's true. So what about these stories a few years ago about these suitcase-sized bombs that were lost?
Well, I wouldn't worry about that. Look, it's true that, you know, if North Korea got a bomb, it could blow up Seoul. Or it's true that a suitcase bomb could blow up New York. I'm talking about the end of the only life in the universe.
As we know it, yeah.
Well, as we know it, I mean, we don't know any other life. I once said to Carl Sagan, who is a friend of mine, the great astronomer, do you think there's any other life in the universe? And he paused for a long time, and then he said no. And I said, why? And he said, because if there was other life forms and they have reached the point of evolution that we have reached, they would have destroyed themselves.
Well, that's a pretty negative outlook, though, isn't it? I mean, is that where you are as well at this stage? Are we?
No.
No?
I'm not there because I do know that the goodness that with which a baby is born still exists, that purity and goodness in everyone's soul. And I do know that people know that they're doing wicked and criminal things because when they're dying on their deathbeds, they tell me what they've done. But what we have to do is we need a leader to rise up who will inspire and stimulate people to rise to their greater good and do the right thing. I know we can fix it. Well, we can't fix the radioactive waste. We can't fix that. But we can close down all the reactors. We can decommission all the nuclear weapons in the world. We can stop burning carbon. We can stop drilling in the Arctic for oil. We can prevent global warming, but we don't have a very big window of time to do that. It's like now or never. What's happened in Rio is just disgusting. But we can fix it. We can fix it. And we can't wring our hands and say it's hopeless because it's never hopeless, you know. And I went to America. I was just a mere woman and an alien. And I led the movement, really, against nuclear weapons. So we can all be as powerful as the most powerful person who ever lived.
All right, very good. This is a big subject, of course, and we do have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask you about it because I don't want to leave it out. Depleted uranium. Many people don't even know about this and what it is. Can you give us a brief rundown and how you view the situation at this point?
When uranium is mined, it's got two isotopes, uranium-235, which is the fissionable one, and uranium-238. 235 is present in 0.7% in natural ore. It must be enriched to 3%, which is what the Iranians are doing and they're entitled to for use in nuclear power. If it's enriched above 70% or more, you can make bombs with it. That's the Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb. Now, left behind is uranium-238, which is not depleted of radiation. It's depleted of its isotope, fellow-isotope 235. It's radioactive waste. It's free. The Pentagon discovered it some years ago, and it's 1.7 times more dense than lead. So if you make an anti-tank shell out of it, as momentum equals velocity by mass, if you have a very heavy mass and you shoot out this anti-tank shell, it slices through the armor of the tank like a hot knife through butter. But it's also pyrophoric, very reactive with air. So when it hits the tank, 80% of it bursts into white hot flames and burns, producing tiny little aerosolized particles less than 5 microns in diameter that can be inhaled into the terminal air passages of the lung. It's very, very carcinogenic, causes cancer. It's a heavy metal, so when children inhale it, they're playing in those devastated tanks, or the dust on the desert floor gets blown around. People inhale it or it gets into their food and they eat it. It's excreted through the kidney like lead, but it can cause acute nephritis and it can cause renal cancer. It's excreted through the semen. And in Basra, where America used 360 tons of it in the first Gulf invasion, children, there's a hugely high incidence of childhood cancer. And my colleagues can't treat the children because of the sanctions and they don't have any drugs. There's a very high incidence of severe congenital anomalies, babies being born with no brains, single eyes, no arms or legs. And then America used a huge amount in Fallujah. The incidence of severe congenital anomalies there is so high now that the doctors have told the women to stop having babies. Uranium-238 has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. So America has conducted a nuclear war in the Middle East, in the cradle of civilization between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, contaminating the area where arithmetic began, the law began, writing began forevermore. And there's virtually no media covering this. They used huge amounts in Baghdad, where there are 5 million people, half of whom are children. Children are very sensitive to radiation. They get cancer much more readily than adults. They're using it in Afghanistan. They're exporting it around the world. They used it in Bosnia. They're using it in Pakistan. Israel is using it, apparently, in Palestine or the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm.
They're nuclear weapons.
Yeah, but it's like a... Well, we can't call it slow nuclear weapon, but it's like it's dispersed in tiny increments instead of one big kaboom, basically.
That's
right. Yeah,
that's right. To be inhaled into the lung to cause lung cancer, bone cancer, leukemia, because uranium goes to the bone, to cause birth deformities, to be excreted in the semen when men ejaculate their sperm, to cause genetic abnormalities, and I could go on and on. There is a huge literature about uranium. We used to use it in medicine. If you read my book, The New Nuclear Danger, there's a chapter on depleted uranium weapons, and read one of my other books, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. I talk about uranium weapons in that as well, and the literature, there's huge literature on uranium. The Pentagon has a large literature on it. They know.
Yeah. I do want to mention some of your books again here, of course, before we begin to round things up. There's a couple of different websites as well. HelenCalicut.com, but also, as you mentioned before, let me bring that up again so I have it, NuclearFreePlanet.org. And some of the book titles we have is Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, Nuclear Madness, Metal of Dishonor, that also goes into depleted uranium, I think, and the new Nuclear Dangerous. Anything else out there, Helen, that you have that you want to mention now before we begin to round things up here?
Yeah, there's another one called If You Love This Planet, a book. My radio show, you can go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org and download many, many, many interviews I've had with people like Ralph Nader and Daniel Ellsberg and people who know all about nuclear power and the like and about Fukushima. I think that's probably all.
Well, very, very good. I mean, it's a very, very disheartening subject, of course, to be into and research and study, and it takes a lot of energy, pun intended here, I guess, that you know, to just go through it and to just dig into all this, because again, the world seems to be mostly hiding or you know, closing their eyes to it. But you know, a final thought on this in a sense, it's you've mentioned it a couple of times now, but it's almost like collectively mankind has a kind of a death wish, as far as you said, and is there anything you can say more about the psychological component to that? You kind of alluded to it earlier, but what's going on? Can we turn it away?
I think a lot depends upon the women of the world. You know, we're 53% of the Earth's population. We're built to nurture and give birth to life.
So it's the men to blame, huh?
Pardon?
It's the men to blame, huh?
Well, I think that women need to rise up. I mean, we allow the men to control the world, and they've done their dash. They've done what they've done, and look at where we are now. And I think it's time that if we really love our children and our grandchildren, I mean, I know if a woman's child is diagnosed with leukemia, she turns into a lioness. I mean, she'll do anything to save that child's life. Sell a house, go to the marriage clinic, do whatever. We need that sort of passion and drive and commitment to save the planet. We absolutely do. And I say, if you love your children and if you love your grandchildren, and I'm not excluding, of course, all mothering men, but I think that's a secret ingredient, and we haven't really used it yet. Women tend to stand back and be shy and not move into positions of power. And I'm not talking about people like Maggie Thatcher, because she was really maybe a man in disguise. I'm just joking. But I'm talking about just normal nurturing women of all varieties. But it's a magic ingredient that has yet to be used to save the planet. And I'm not excluding, as I said, all really caring, intelligent, loving men.
All right, we have some gremlins moving back on the line here. We're calling you in Australia, of course, so but the line has been pretty okay so far here today. But we want to thank you for your time, Helen. Really appreciate it. Again, the website, websites, helencaldicott.com. If you love this planet.org, check out their radio shows there as well, as Helen mentioned, and also nuclearfreeplanet.org. Again, we really appreciate it. Keep up the great work, and yeah, go at it, huh?
Thanks, Heinrich.
We have a lot of interesting guests coming up on Red Ice Radio. Janice Barcelo, Drunvel Melchizedek, Daniel Pinchbeck, Bryce Sable, Courtney Brown, Freeman and Jamie, John Irvin, Duncan Wordley, and Joseph Atville with Fritz Heed. Stay tuned to redicecreations.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope to talk to you soon.